Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, the search widens for the missing Malaysia Airlines jet. A commission presents its finding about human rights violations in North Korea, and we hear how Roman Catholic missionaries work in a changing world. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. China is pressing Malaysian authorities to better coordinate search efforts for the missing flight MH370 and to release information more quickly. As the search effort pushed into its 10th day, Malaysia asked Australia to lead the search for the missing flight in the Indian Ocean. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
With the search operation expanding to include some 26 countries and efforts shifting in large arcs to the north and south of Malaysia's west coast, China is again raising concerns over a lack of information about the investigation. At a regular news briefing on Monday, China's foreign ministry once again urged Malaysia to provide more information about where to direct search efforts. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei says the search operation faces even more difficulties with the scope expanding. Hong says China hopes Malaysia will better coordinate all the search efforts. The majority of the 239 people on board the Boeing 777 jet were Chinese nationals. On Monday, state-run China Daily, China's most prominent overseas English publication, argued that Malaysia's piecemeal and contradictory information has made search efforts difficult and the entire incident even more mysterious. An editorial in the Hong Kong-based South China Morning Post asked, "Is Malaysia fit to lead the widening search for missing flight MH370? In it, the paper's editor-in-chief, Wang Xiangwei, suggested that it was time for Beijing to step up and lead the operation. Wang says Beijing should use its influence to press nations to work more closely to solve the mystery. However, when asked about that option at a news conference Monday, China's foreign ministry made it clear that Malaysia is still in charge. Malaysian authorities say the vanished passenger jet could be in two possible corridors based on satellite tracking data received nearly 8 hours after the plane took off. One corridor stretches north, up across some 11 countries, including China, all the way to Kazakhstan in Central Asia. The other sweeps south toward Indonesia and the deep waters of the southern Indian Ocean. Authorities in Pakistan and India say radar along their borders did not pick up the plane. Given that, some experts say that if the plane did go north to Central Asia, it could have traveled over Burma and the Himalayan plateau and perhaps through Chinese airspace. It is unclear what Chinese authorities have found so far in their review of their radar information. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei says Malaysia has requested that China share such information and that China has noticed that other countries have already responded. Hong says that whatever will help in the search, China will actively cooperate. In Beijing, families voiced their outrage with the pace of the search and apparent missteps by Malaysian authorities. One man, surnamed Nguyen, says that if Malaysia had also referred to satellite data much earlier on, then they wouldn't have wasted time searching the east side of the Malaysian peninsula. Nguyen says Malaysia has made a big mess. Who would take flights run by Malaysia, he asked. Who would dare to do business there, he added. Like other families and many online in China, Nguyen believes Malaysia is withholding information. As the search expands, analysts say the endeavor will greatly depend on the ability of not only Malaysia to share information, but all of the countries to the north and south of where the plane is believed to have traveled. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, Afghan authorities prepare for the presidential election. An international commission of inquiry is presenting its findings on human rights abuses in North Korea to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva today. The three-member commission was formed by the council last March, led by Australian jurist Michael Kirby, in the most serious international effort to date to document evidence of a systematic and grave human rights violations that could amount to crimes against humanity. The commission interviewed defectors, witnesses, and experts who detailed decades of systematic executions, torture, rape, and mass starvation in the North's prison network. Pyongyang has refused to take part in the investigation and has rejected the commission's report. Speaking to reporters Friday before taking part in today's meeting in Geneva, Ambassador Robert King, special U.S. envoy on North Korean human rights issues, says the nearly year-long investigation by the three-person panel was a transparent and extensive process.
The commission held a series of public hearings in Seoul, in Tokyo, in London, in Washington. They heard from victims of human rights abuse in North Korea. They heard from specialists who analyze and understand academically what's going on in North Korea. They held private meetings with witnesses who preferred not to appear in public because of relatives still living in North Korea. It was a remarkably transparent and open process. Most of the hearings that were held were public hearings to which there were a large number of people who observed the hearings. The hearings were videoed, and they're available online on the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights webpage. There's also a transcript of what was said during the course of the investigation. The U.S. has been a strong supporter of this process. We have been an active participant. We've been engaged with the Commission of Inquiry, with other members of the Human Rights Council in terms of the preparation for the report. We welcome this spotlight on human rights conditions in North Korea. We think it's helpful to understand what's going on in North Korea. We think it's helpful to have an international body looking at these issues. And we appreciate this opportunity to examine what's going on with regard to North Korea's human rights record.
Ambassador Robert King says an improvement in bilateral relations with North Korea would depend on an improvement in its human rights record. He says a draft resolution is being prepared by the European Union and Japan to recommend the COI be referred to the International Criminal Court, although China, with veto in the UN Security Council, could block that resolution. King says Washington continues to press North Korea on human rights and says the number of refugees allowed to leave under the North's new leader, Kim Jong-un, has declined. Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director of Human Rights Watch, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the search for justice will be a long one in this case.
No one is deceived here. No one thinks that this is going to be easy. It's certainly going to be a long road, but I think that Europe and North America and Japan and other key countries around the world are in it for the long haul. They recognize that after 60 years of these abuses going on, hidden from view, that it's time for the UN to step up and actually ensure that there is accountability for these incredible crimes against the North Korean people.
This meeting in Geneva will span 2 weeks. What do you expect to happen over those 2 weeks, and what might happen after its conclusion?
Certainly tomorrow we'll have Justice Kirby and the commissioners from the Commission of Inquiry making their presentations to the Human Rights Council, and I expect there will be a very hearty debate. And we'll see a resolution coming forward. That resolution now is still in the process of being negotiated by key governments. But the European Union and the United States are on board with a very strong resolution. Japan also is working on that. And so I expect that even though we will see a vote at the Human Rights Council, it won't go through by consensus, the North Korean resolution will be adopted. And we're calling to ensure that not only that the Commission of Inquiry's recommendations are endorsed, but that also this matter is sent to the UN Security Council, because it is a grave situation. It is crimes against humanity here, and this is where the Security Council should act by referring this to the International Criminal Court.
With China's permanent status on the Security Council, do you expect a veto?
Well, it's likely. Everybody's a realist about that. But I think we need to recognize also that there are costs to China defending what will now be understood to be among the worst of the world's human rights violators. North Korea doesn't get a free pass anymore, and China will not get a free pass either in defending that government. Going forward now, the key is that there be a strong resolution at the Human Rights Council. Many people are watching closely, expecting the Human Rights Council members to really stand up and recognize that this is the sort of situation that the UN was created for. When you have just such pervasive, systematic crimes against humanity taking place, this is part of the history of the UN, which was set up after the atrocities during World War II. And now we have this situation happening again, and the UN has to take a very firm stand.
Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch. Stephen Norper, Senior Vice President of the New York-based Korea Society, tells Victor Beatty over time he hopes for an accounting and trial for the atrocities documented in the commission's report, similar to the UN proceedings against Khmer Rouge officials in Cambodia.
A lot of it will be left up to the way that the Korean people manage their integration process. But this is a terribly important time because the international community has, through the United Nations, done a first comprehensive report. And the results are just striking. In a world that knows human rights abuses, there is no other place on the face of this globe that has seen the atrocities in 2014 now than North Korea. And that does demand answers and does demand accountability.
Your confidence in the commission going ahead is based on just the weight of the evidence compiled?
Well, the evidence is significant. Now, they've been trying to downplay the expectation on it going anywhere, largely based on objections they anticipate from China. For something to be referred to the International Criminal Court, there would have to be the agreement of China as a member of the Permanent Five in the United Nations Security Council. The anticipation is China would veto that. But the bigger question, Victor, is in the long term, what does China get from this? At what point do they see a rationale for defending the world's worst violators of human rights? It's all part of a greater trade-off. At what point does China consider North Korea too much of a burden to want to support it as a major patron? Whether or not we see a referral to the ICC, whether or not it results in something in the near term, it's incredibly important there would be such a request and a referral put forward, even if in the United Nations Security Council, China vetoes it. It's still significant to put forward as a symbolic gesture that may one day see fruition.
That could take months, perhaps years.
It could take months. It could take years. And remember, there are interim measures that could take place. One is that the year-long investigation that was put into effect with the call by United Nations High Commissioner Navi Pillay was a year long. And so there could be a renewal that is put forward to the international community, an ongoing investigation, as it were, which would certainly keep the pressure on North Korea. And there's all sorts of other types of measures, sanctions and others, that could be discussed over time. Remember that South Korea will have a turn at the presidency in May. This issue may come up in the United Nations Security Council under their leadership. But really, it's an international issue. So under anyone's leadership, there needs to be a tremendous amount of attention paid to this report. And the report is really striking. The testimonials that were given are stark. Everything from outright murder to infanticide, and the atrocities are just so glaring that it demands an international response. So whether or not this leads to something at The Hague in the near term, perhaps doubtful. Ultimately, it's certainly a possibility.
Stephen Norper of the Korea Society and Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute says while it's important for the world community to know what goes on inside North Korea, it may be counterproductive in the short term to seek criminal indictments against the North Korean leadership. He says Pyongyang's human rights record may only deepen the North's isolation and forestall efforts at reunification with South Korea. Afghan authorities say necessary security measures are in place to guard the upcoming presidential polls, dismissing concerns Taliban threats and violence against election officials risk undermining the crucial vote. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Afghanistan's elections for president and 458 provincial councillors are slated for April 5th. But deadly attacks on campaign workers and election officials have worried local as well as international observers. Since the start of the campaign period 6 weeks ago, independent monitors have reported at least 7 murders, 1 assassination attempt and several incidents of election-related violence and intimidation. The Taliban insurgency has vowed to use all force to disrupt the polls and has warned Afghans not to participate in it. Human Rights Watch has criticized as despicable and unlawful the Taliban's threat to use violence to prevent voters from choosing a new president. It has urged Afghan authorities to take all possible steps to protect campaign activities and voters. An Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman, Mohammad Najib Nekzat, says the government is fully prepared to organize free and transparent elections. He tells VOA about 400,000 Afghan soldiers and policemen are ready for deployment across the country to deter any threat to the democratic process.
Among the intakhabat that takano da para tul amadegi nivale shavidi de Afghanistan lakhana.
The spokesman dismissed the Taliban's threat of violence as propaganda, saying the Afghan government is not concerned and such moves will not prevent it from holding the elections. He added that only 4 districts across Afghanistan face serious security threats, but steps are being taken to deal with the challenge. While testifying before U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington last week, the top American commander in Afghanistan, General Joseph Dunford, also warned of an increase in the election-related violence, but said physical ability of the Afghan security forces is sufficient to deal with the security challenge.
There is no doubt in my mind, and we know this both from our intelligence and from open source, that the insurgency is focused on disrupting the elections in 2014 and focused on crushing the spirit and the will of the Afghan forces in 2014. Because they believe that we are leaving at the end of 2014, they look at this as a very critical year. And so what we expect to see are high-profile attacks to create the perception of insecurity.
The NATO-led international force will end its combat mission in December. The fate of a smaller American military presence in Afghanistan post-2014 remains uncertain because President Hamid Karzai has refused to sign a bilateral security agreement with Washington until certain conditions are met. On Sunday, former Afghan Defense Minister Rahim Vardak said he is withdrawing from the presidential race and will not endorse any other candidate. He did not give any reason for ending his campaign and was not considered a front-runner. Earlier this month, the current president's elder brother, Qayyum Karzai, announced he was ending his presidential campaign and supporting a former foreign minister, Zalmay Rasool, who is widely perceived as President Karzai's favored candidate. There are 10 male candidates in the race to replace President Karzai, who is unable to run in next month's vote due to constitutional term limits. In his last address to the joint session of parliament in Kabul Saturday, the Afghan leader reaffirmed his resolve to hold transparent and free elections. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. The work of missionary priests and nuns seems more dangerous than ever, at least from statistics showing killings of missionaries doubled last year. For centuries, Christian missionaries have faced danger, but the nature of the threat they face is very different today, as is the context in which they operate. From Paris, Lisa Bryant takes a look for VOA at the challenges facing one of France's oldest Roman Catholic missionary societies.
The small church in downtown Paris is packed with family and friends gathered to bid goodbye to the latest graduates of the Roman Catholic Foreign Missions Society of Paris. The young priests are heading off to challenging and sometimes risky assignments in Asian countries like China and Vietnam. Unlike other jobs, this one is for life. 24-year-old Will Conker still has a few years before he can join them. He's one of 27 seminarians training at the Mission Society.
I spent a year in Vietnam 3 years ago working for the Catholic Church there. I saw a church that is on fire for Christ, on fire for the mission, on fire for freedom and justice in this world. They call us to go back to Asia and to live with the church in Asia.
But so serving that calling can be risky. The Rome-based Fides news agency reports that 22 missionaries, priests, nuns, and laymen, were killed last year, almost twice as many as in 2012. Most of the deaths took place in Latin America during robberies and other petty crimes that turned into murder. Other missionaries have been abducted in places like Syria and Democratic Republic of Congo, their whereabouts uncertain. Missionary work has always been dangerous. In years gone by, hundreds of Catholic and Protestant missionaries were killed preaching the gospel in the Americas, Africa, and Asia, and others died of disease. The Mission Society's Superior General, the Reverend Georges Colomb, said until the 20th century, a missionary priest usually died before reaching the age of 40.
D'une certaine manière, on peut dire que c'est moins dangereux parce que autrefois,
the society has a special hall of martyrs honoring its priests who died in violent circumstances.
Les autres pays, certains pays, nous sommes présents avec un visa qui n'est pas un visa missionnaire.
Colomb says his priests still face problems today in many countries. Getting a visa as a missionary is difficult, if not impossible, in places like Malaysia, China, and Vietnam. So many priests travel as students, teachers, or even as tourists.
Mais si on veut vivre un petit peu un défi, certains défis qui sont propres à la mission.
Young people join knowing they will live in countries where the Catholic Church and community are sometimes persecuted, where poverty is dire, and where other religions and traditions dominate. They want to prove themselves. Founded 350 years ago, the Foreign Mission Society is one of the oldest missionary groups in France. Its 240 priests work in more than a dozen countries, mostly in Asia. They're among the estimated 3,000 priests, nuns, and laypeople who serve the French Catholic Church overseas, a number significantly lower than in the past, reflecting Europe's secular trend. The Reverend Jean Forgeat, Deputy Director for Missionary Activities at the Council of French Bishops, says the missionary task is unique.
La tâche des missionnaires n'a pas changé depuis très longtemps. Depuis très, très, très longtemps.
Missionaries have always promoted faith in the gospel, Forgeat says, but they work for human development. Professor Dries Van Isacker says missionaries today face new hazards that underscore the dramatically different context in which they now operate. Van Isacker is an expert on missionaries at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium.
I would not say that it is less dangerous today to be a missionary than 100 years ago. At the contrary, maybe they are more involved with all the people than before. And that's, I think, a more dangerous way of living nowadays than 100 years ago. Because 100 years ago, they are much more protected with powerful means than today.
The Foreign Mission Society in Paris also prepares its priests for their new lives. 3 years of in-country language training, for example, is mandatory. At the going-away ceremony for new missionaries, Pierre Nguyen, a 34-year-old priest heading for South Korea, says he is aware of the political and cultural context he will work in.
En fait, notre vocation est missionnaire et d'aider à fonder l'église locale.
Nguyen sees his task as helping to build bridges between his flock in Korea and Catholics worldwide. He says he will face the challenges ahead with serenity. At the end of the farewell service, the priests file into the mission's vast garden. They carry small candles to light their way in the night, just as they hope their faith will light their way later on. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Missionaries preparing to serve overseas. Well, thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki coming up next.